Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for a very special Food for Thought conversation. I'm Kira Amstutz, president of the Indiana Humanities Council, and we're delighted to partner with Indiana's Family of Farmers to host today's discussion, Food for Thought: How Can Hoosiers End Hunger? When people talk about hunger, they tend to approach the discussion in one of two ways. Some people point first to the startling numbers, like 1 billion. That's the estimated number of people who are undernourished worldwide. Or 300 million, the number of children classified as chronically hungry. Or 200,000, the number of Hoosiers estimated to be living with hunger this winter. The other option is to put a human face on hunger. That's the approach one of today's participants used in the preface to his book, Enough: Why the World's Poorest Starve in an Age of Plenty. The truth is, either approach often leaves us feeling powerless, overwhelmed by both the massive scale and the stunning human tragedy of hunger. In today's discussion, we'll consider some of the causes of hunger, as well as possible solutions. We'll talk about what's being done on a global and local scale, and learn more about Hoosiers leading the way. And we'll talk about how we as individuals can make a difference. Participating in today's conversation, in addition to a wonderful audience, are three men who bring unique perspectives to the consideration of hunger. First, I'd like to introduce Roger Thoreau, the Senior Fellow for Global Agriculture and Food Policy for the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Previously a Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent for more than three decades, that's not possible. Roger covered some of the world's biggest events. In 2003, he and colleague Scott Kilman turned their attention to famine in Africa, writing a series of stories that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, which uses both shocking statistics and intimately human stories to expose the global problems behind hunger and offer solutions. Next, I welcome Ted McKinney, a native Hoosier who serves as a senior director for global corporate affairs for Elanco Animal Health. Ted is a veteran of the agriculture and food science industry. Previously, he led Dow AgroSciences U.S. food chain and state government affairs, and he currently serves on the board of the International Food Information Council. A Purdue University alum, you know I had to get that in there, and former Purdue Pete, Ted is a graduate of the Stanley K. Lacey Leadership Series and an involved member of the Central Indiana community. Finally, I'd like to introduce Jerry Adams, the Director of Operations for Levy Restaurants at Conseco Fieldhouse. Jerry's resume includes leadership roles in food operations for some of America's biggest stadiums and event facilities, but it also includes leadership in community programs. The chairman of the board for Second Helpings Indianapolis, Jerry is a driving force behind Levy Cares, the Levy Restaurants nonprofit entity that works to help people affected by homelessness, hunger, and HIV/AIDS. Previously, he served on the executive committee of Forgotten Harvest in Detroit. So we will start our conversation today with some brief remarks by our panelists and then open the conversation for questions from all of you. So Roger, let's get started with you. How did you become involved in writing about hunger? And what did you hope to accomplish by writing Enough?
Thank you, Karen. Thanks for having me here. I don't know if I'm the only Hoosier, the non-Hoosier in the audience, but I'm from Illinois, so I'm
you're very close.
I'm a good neighbor, and a Midwesterner. Started writing about hunger, I guess, probably in about a decade ago. I was with the Wall Street Journal, as you said, a foreign correspondent for many years. I'd spent a lot of time in Africa, but for most of my reporting in Africa, hunger was kind of the wallpaper and the noise of Africa. I'm ashamed to say. Now I was based in South Africa and doing a lot of things kind of with the end of, I was there during the last gas period of apartheid and Nelson Mandela's release. I was kind of preoccupied with that. But it wasn't until the famine of, in Ethiopia in 2003 that really grabbed my, attention. I guess what I saw there, made me really think about the issue. Why was hunger and famine still happening in the 21st century? How had we brought hunger with us into the 21st century when the Green Revolution was one of the great technological and scientific achievements and wonders of the 20th century? And here we were in the first years of the 21st century, and there was so much hunger that was kind of rampant through Africa that year. And so I think it was writing about that that made me realize that as reporters and journalists, and particularly as foreign correspondents, we're always moving from story to story, country to country. When I came to Ethiopia, saw what was happening there, all these questions coming to my mind of why is this happening, I decided that this is the story that I need to concentrate on. It was time to stop roaming around, going from story to story, and that that is the one that I needed to concentrate on. And soon all other stories began paling in comparison to that one. I knew that's the one that I need to concentrate on. So it was kind of almost like a calling in a sense that all my previous years at the Wall Street Journal and foreign corresponding had led me to that, story. And what we tried to do in Enough, so Scott Kilman, my colleague at the Wall Street Journal, we had done then in the following years a number of stories on hunger and agriculture development, food security, issues on food aid, subsidies, agriculture investment and what was necessary, particularly looking at the question of why did the Green Revolution never come to Africa. And I told Scott at one stage that my soul wouldn't rest unless we did a book and we put everything that we knew into a book. And that then eventuates in Enough. And what we tried to do in Enough, I think our mantra in writing the book was, and our main goals was, outrage and inspire. We wanted to outrage people that we had brought hunger with us into the 21st century, and that was absolutely unacceptable. Not only have we brought hunger with us into the 21st century, but at ever-increasing numbers, and the billion that you mentioned is utterly shocking, that we still have a billion chronically hungry people in this world, in this day and age, when we're producing more food than ever before. So that was the outrage, and the inspire part of it, that hunger is the one issue of the great issues facing us today, and humanitarian issues. Hunger is probably the issue that we could that is solvable, that we can actually do. We have the experience, we have the know-how, we have the technology. A lot of it coming from people from Indiana that have been on the front lines of this issue. And so we figured, if we can kind of motivate people through outrage and inspiration that this can be done. There are these examples of people that are doing things and making a big difference. And hopefully that we could then kind of turn this issue of ending hunger through agriculture development into the great populist cause of this decade.
One of the things that I noticed in your book, you talk a little bit, or maybe it was in an interview, about how often reporters are viewed as cynics. But this has made you into an optimist. Maybe give us one example of why you're optimistic before we move on to Ted.
Yeah, I think just seeing kind of the impact that some things have made. I mean, if you just look at say the Indiana University Kenya partnership and what's going on there with Dr. Mamlin, I think he was really a pioneer in the thinking, or getting people to think, and certainly made me think when I was out there kind of sitting, in the yard of his house with these kind of flowers around him and things, and kind of surrounded by the critical and urgent work that he was doing and is doing out there, that hunger is basically the fundamental element of all development issues. If you don't get on top of the hunger issue, how are you going to solve the rest of them? You can build as many schools as you want in Africa, for instance, or as many libraries, but if the children going to those schools are malnourished, are chronically hungry, have no food, they're not learning as they should. And what he was experiencing, and it was a great revelation, is that on the hunger or on the AIDS front, the AIDS drugs don't do as well as they should, and don't have kind of the impact or the great Lazarus effect that they can have in hungry, malnourished, and starving bodies. And he then kind of, banging away against the walls of bureaucracy that said these are the AIDS treatment protocols in the world. At that time, they did not really have a hunger or nutrition component to them. And he kept saying it has to have that component, because otherwise what good does all our efforts to flood Africa with these AIDS drugs, which needs to happen, is a very laudable effort. But so he was kind of sitting at this deadly crossroads of AIDS and hunger in Africa, and realizing that you have to tackle both of them at the same time. So the progress that they've made and on that. So when you see things like that, and what say, organizations like Bread for the World and the lobbying and advocacy successes that they've had with raising the alarms in Washington and in the halls of power And just so that there's just, you know, a lot of progress that has been made, in addition to a lot of failure at the same time, that just leads one to think, that this is something that we can have success at.
Well, it's nice to know that you have that optimism, given all that remains to be done. And I know, Ted, your experience at Elanco is also both personal and professional. I mean, I think you can share with us perhaps a little bit of the optimism you feel in being involved on some of the technology sides of trying to solve the problem, as well as some of the local initiatives. So maybe you can fill us in on that.
Well, sure. My journey quickly has been from growing up on a farm here in Tipton, Indiana, just an hour north of Indianapolis, where we saw both the bounty that comes from some of the finest farmland in the world, but on those occasions at the time, migrant workers would come in to mostly harvest tomatoes, sometimes detassel seed corn, and you had a glimpse at hunger. And the idea was that that experience got me periodically out of my bubble, where you largely had plenty. And then it was revisited several times. I know our good friend and many of us here in the room, Jim Morris, when he went to Rome to head up the World Food Program, that gave another and different lens into the world of the hungry. And then now more recently with Elanco Animal Health, we're the division of Eli Lilly and Company with a focus on animal health products. And I'd say largely it's been a mission of our president and of my colleagues to really seriously address hunger, not just from our products, which I'll speak about in a moment, but from a personal level. It takes both to really engage and blow out of this bubble. We were taken as a company, as individuals, by a study issued by the Food and Ag Organization of the United Nations and confirmed by many, many economists worldwide. And it's three numbers. It's 50, 100, 70. And the concept here is that by 2050, we'll need 100% more food. We'll need to double food production. And that the conclusion is that 70% of that must come from technology. So technology offers an array of things. It is not just high tech. Many times it's cited as biotechnology. It is that, but it's not just that. And when we look at that, we then step back. In many cases, some of the wonderful discussions from the Food for Thought program that the Humanities Council advanced, which oftentimes pits honest, well-meaning people that may be pursuing organic versus other honest, well-meaning people who might be a large production operation. And so we engage because we don't want the debate to be one or the other. It's both. We believe very firmly that there is a very strong place for choice, people who want a lifestyle decision. I'm one of those. I love my Starbucks coffee. It's a lifestyle choice. I'm willing and wanting to pay a little more. Occasionally I'll buy some organic materials. But nor is that the answer to feed that 100% more necessity. And so we engage because we believe there is room for both. And if it becomes a we versus they, we are ultimately doomed to fail. So our company is in it because of the technology. We've been all about technology for 57 years. We bring products that help livestock grow more efficiently, that keeps them healthy and well through antibiotics and the like. We're now in a companion animal, which is all about that human-animal bond that's so critical. And yeah, we're unabashedly fans of bringing technology on our own family farm, biotechnology crops. They also have conventional crops. It's both. And markets will serve both. But if we're not addressing technology, we will not get there. We will not follow in the footsteps of Norman Borlaug, who brought those dwarf varieties of wheat and rice, or those who brought on biotechnology who are bringing more food and different foods. And by the way, bringing it locally. One of the things that excited me so when we were working with biotechnology with Dow AgriSciences was the opportunity to take and let a farmer in Africa, Roger, to pick up on some of your visits, grow more cotton, sell it, raise the income level for their families, put their kids through school. That just warms the heart. Or, Jerry, we'll get to you in a moment, but I think of some of the technologies, healthy oils that were developed that are bringing not only a healthier oil, but an oil that's necessary by the body to foods that you all produce at Conseco. So that's the technology center. We need that. But that alone is not enough. And I think the corporate world's coming to realize that the technology and what we produce and products out there speaking for themselves isn't enough. Mm-hmm. It's not enough. That unless there's that personal engagement where you have that personal relationship with someone who's hungry, mm-hmm. you don't make that connection up and down that food chain. And that's what we're engaged in now. Elanco is on a mission by 2025 to bring 100,000 families out of hunger. And so far we're tracking. It involves international. We've engaged with Heifer International. We have projects in Indonesia. And last year we started the second one in Zambia. Mm-hmm. And we hope to have another one announced later this year. Mm-hmm. And that's where you're really addressing hunger in its most pristine case. You know, it's the mm-hmm. kind of experience, Roger, that you saw. But we also hope to announce later this year another new product with the Child Hunger Initiative right here in Indianapolis, where we engage to bring Indianapolis, particularly children in Indianapolis, out of hunger. And we have found that that connection of the personal mm-hmm. with the technology is that nirvana that has brought engagement and passion from our employees to just all-time highs. We see both.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the perspective you bring because you're taking the global and bringing it local. And I think with our next guest, we're going to really kind of dig in a little bit deeper to some of the things that are going on here in Indianapolis and in central Indiana to not only support people who are hungry, but Jerry has experience leading the way from a corporate perspective as well. So, Jerry, why don't you talk to us a little bit about perhaps what motivated you to be involved in the issue? And what kinds of things that are happening with Second Helpings and with Levy Restaurants?
My motivation, unfortunately, was firsthand knowledge of what it was like to be hungry. I was raised in a single family with nine sisters and brothers. We were on food stamps. And back in those days, you could get 2 boxes of cereal and a gallon of milk for $5. And that was breakfast every day. The two things I didn't have as a child was food and clothes. So I ended up in the food business because I didn't want to be hungry, and it seemed to have worked out very well, as you can see. But I have, in my travels, I work for a great organization that has a charitable arm that really encourages and allows us, because someday Second Helpings is my second job, mm-hmm. to be involved in the community and do those kind of things. Hunger is hunger is an issue, but it's a byproduct of other issues, and poverty would be the key to that. And I think with Second Helpings, a lot of people are familiar with food pantries, and you can go in and you can get canned goods and you can get things to make food. We recycle food. We rescue food that would otherwise go into a garbage dump somewhere. 40% of the food consumed in America or prepared for consumption is thrown away, to the tune of $100 billion a year. And we're different in your traditional food pantries in that we provide prepared foods. We serve 58 agencies in central Indiana in 3 counties. 13 of those are United Way agencies. 48% of the recipients of our food are kids. And those are kids that would not otherwise eat. We send in prepared food. So literally that after school program, the parent can come in with the child and have a hot meal before they go home. Our agencies span the globe of kitchens and soup kitchens and pantries and battered women shelters. We kind of cover a lot of that. The other thing that we found with some great partnerships with Kroger and U.S. Foods and Sysco is that we redirect about 67% of the food that we get because we get cans and we get other things. So a great story is St. Vincent de Paul is one of our partners. They have Tabernacle Missionary Baptist Church is next door. So one of our board members said, you know, all these people come to St. Vincent de Paul, and they do a phenomenal job. It's a very dignified process. You get a card, and you get to select 20 items. You go through just like a grocery store. People will help you bag. And so our last board retreat, I said, we have great people sitting around the table. We have a tremendous board, and we're all about doing the right things, but do we really understand what the problems are? So instead of having another board meeting, as they like to say, drawing T-shirts, we went into the community and started visiting the agencies. We found out from St. Vincent de Paul that we saved them $95,000 a year because that's what they were spending for meat through our partnership with Kroger. they can now take $100,000 and fund a new program. Well, one of our board members said, wouldn't it be great, all these people come in and shop, we could have a hot meal and they could eat before they leave. And Peter, and God bless, he's a wonderful man, he says, I really appreciate that, but we have 2 minutes from the time somebody walks through the front door to they need to walk out of the back door to make this work. We stock our shelves, people come shopping, we shut it down, we replenish, we open the door. So we were able to go next door and provide hot meals where people could actually go and eat, then go next door and shop, and they had a hot meal. You'll see people leaving shelters, leaving pantries with bags of food, but it's Twinkies and Ho-Hos. There's no nutritional value in the bag. And that's really, you know, the biggest, I have a lot of Jerryisms, and one of the things that I say to people is there ain't no politics in feeding hungry people. And there's a lot of people with great intentions that are working together independently. And I have to tell you that the city of Indianapolis, and I am from Chicago, so you don't sit along, but we're a good neighbor. We were sitting one day at a board table and we were talking about how could we get everybody to work together. We got with the mayor's office and the miners have been very instrumental in what is now the Indiana Food Resource Network. We have Sequoia, Connect 211, Interfaith Hunger Initiative, Gleaners, food stamps. I mean, everybody coming together to talk about, there are 274 places in the city of Indianapolis where you could get food. Some of them are the two nuns who open from Tuesday from 2 to 4, and you can only get stuff there if you're Catholic. And and it doesn't work for the working poor. You need to be open when they are working, so how can they? So it's really about how do we take all these well-meaning people and get them to work together, and it really becomes there ain't no politics in feeding hungry people, and there should not be any egos in that either. And the Indiana Food Resource Network is really, I believe, taking a stand to demonstrate, and one day I hope that we can say that Indianapolis is a model that the rest of the company can mirror in how we all come together and we address the issue of poverty. And Second Helpers not only feed hungry people, we feed 2,900 people a day, 6 days a week, but we also have a culinary job training program where we take unemployed and unemployable people. A lot of them have been they have issues and really no skills, and we try to develop those folks. So we rescue food, we feed hungry people, and we try to train people in a meaningful role that they can become law-abiding, tax-paying, stand-up citizens. And these are young men and women who have children. And if you look at the process of hunger, it's a cycle. And at some point, we have to break the cycle. So when that dad now has a job that he can go home and tell his kid about, and he's no longer doing things that aren't good things for a family setting, that child's going to start repeating that behavior. And until we get to a complete cycle of that, we're still going to have a problem.
What a powerful example of how that cycle works, and how inspiring that within the Indianapolis community we're seeing more leadership on convening people and bringing people together to make all of our work stronger. I just think that's a terrific message, and it's one, unfortunately, that still too few people know. I loved your comment about there's no politics in feeding hungry people. One of the things that we found in the Food for Thought initiative is there are a lot of passionate people with a lot of perspectives on any issue related to food, whether it's, you know, obesity, hunger, production, distribution, you name it. But I think hunger is that unifying cause that people can really put their egos aside and put their labels aside and come together to help solve, because it is that fundamental piece. The opening question I have for all three of you, and then we'll start taking questions from the audience. Jerry, we'll start with you. What do you think is the biggest myth about hunger?
There's not enough food. There is more food than we will ever be able to consume on this earth. There is plenty of food. It's a matter of leadership, and it's a matter of collaboration. And I think that people have to understand what the mission is. We can feed the body, but that doesn't do anything. We all know the story of teaching a man a fish or giving him a fishing pole. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the difference between people feel good about being able to provide an opportunity to feed a hungry person, but that person's going to be hungry again tomorrow if we don't do something to address the issue of poverty. And people think that it's not enough. Mm-hmm. no pun intended, there is plenty of food to feed the world hungry. And I think that that's a myth that is really a myth.
Well, I would agree that's probably the biggest myth. I'm going to address a different one just for the different perspective. I think there's a myth out there that suggests that big is bad. Big farming is bad. Big technology is bad. Big business is bad. And you can always find those rare examples, and they're there. But I think we've got to dispel that myth because there is efficiency that comes with scale. Now, I say that and happily endorse that small organic backyard farmer. I know some, I embrace them, I've helped them. So this is not a one or the other, back to my original point.
Okay. What about you, Roger?
Yeah.
Talk about some in your book.
Yeah, I would kind of second the notion of both Jerry and Ted. And I'll say, I think that one of the big myths, I think, and particularly about international hunger, is that hunger basically is something that affects other people. It's over there. As Jerry would well know, I mean, it is in the United States, it is among us. It is people that we wouldn't suspect that are going to the food pantries and using the great services of the food banks. And we can kind of say, yeah, you know, hunger's kind of the horrible, famine. I just returned from Kenya over the weekend, and another hunger crisis is building there in a cup by the end of March. I think they're expecting that 5 million people will be needing to be fed by the World Food Program and through food aid and assist us and outside assistance. But that, you know, what is happening in Africa affects us, and it affects us all, both on just a moral issue: what kind of world are we living in that has a billion chronically hungry people? But then also for the matter of global security. I mean, what we saw during the food crisis of 2007 and 2008, when there were shortages and the grain stockpiles in the world were kind of falling to their lowest level in decades, prices were skyrocketing of commodities, the impact in the poorer countries of the world. There was rioting in dozens of countries around the world. It caused the government of Haiti to fall. The government of Haiti, we have to remember, fell because of the food crisis and the food riots in Haiti, not because of the earthquake that happened last year, and that we're all linked together on the food chain. And as Ted pointed out, this is a really critical issue and a great challenge, I think, or perhaps one of the great challenge that we're facing in coming decades, of the need to double food production by 2050 to both meet the demand from the increasing population in the world, but the increasing prosperity of that population that fortunately is people move into the middle class in China and India, formerly hungry people, in some of the places of Africa and in throughout the developing world or the emerging world. We need to double food production in the world by that, by 2050 to meet that. One of the critical areas, and I think, and why I was back in Kenya and spending time in Africa again this year, is that in that effort to double food production, Africa's farmers are essential and indispensable, and we continue to neglect and ignore Africa's farmers, and we continue to neglect and ignore the hunger problem in Africa at our own peril. And Ted's talking about, say, technology, that the farmers in Africa, the hybrid corn, the hybrid maize seed that basically caused yields in the United States to skyrocket and ascend on a straight line upward, that kind of came in the 1920s and 1930s, they're now just starting to be spread in Africa. Probably, you know, 20% or less than 20% of the corn, of the maize that's grown in Africa, is from hybrid seeds. The rest is still from old traditional seeds that lose their genetic capability and yields every year that they use them. So that's just, you know, one thing. So basically getting, you know, being able to double and triple yields in Africa, we have the technology to do that. We have the know-how to do that. What we need is the political will to do that. We're starting to see that emerge some in the Obama administration with the Feed the Future initiative, which is probably, you know, the greatest thrust of American leadership on this effort to end hunger through agriculture development since the Green Revolution, you know, in the 1960s and 1970s. Now we'll see if Congress steps up and funds that program and authorizes that program. But you know, kind of getting bringing finally the Green Revolution or this agricultural transformation or whatever you want to call it to Africa so that the farmers and three-quarters, 70%, three-quarters of the people in Africa and most African countries are small farmers. They're the ones that are hungry. It's one of the great kind of ironies and great tragedies and paradoxes of Africa that the hungriest people are farmers. I mean, hungry farmers is like it's an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. It should be, but it's a truism. And through this Feed the Future initiative, the aim basically, as Ted was saying, is to both increase the production for the farmers in Africa through technology, through investments, through the whole range of the value chain, but also make it then possible for them to be able to sell their surplus crops to have this improved income and basically to be able to send their kids to school and do other things that can get them out of poverty.
Let me just pick up on that one thing just to add to that. Our Heifer International project in Zambia, as we've done some calculations, it's going famously. It's going very well. They're building a business. They're using, I think, ducks in this case mostly to do that. But we've calculated, and with the dairy, there's some dairy there, but we've calculated that at their current rate of improvement, they're going to hit a point where they're going to have to start dumping milk because they don't have a market. And so part of your book, Roger, I know, is there's got to be the policies, the economics, and the marketplace to make it all work. So it's not just about delivering food, producing food. It's got to be something sustained. And so it's this incredible cycle and network of factors.
Exactly. I was going to say kind of one of the other myths that kind of Jerry referred to this, that there's not enough food. There is enough food. And that the efforts and the thinking that, well, if we increase production, that'll solve things. It's happened over and over and over again. Increases in production without the commensurate investments in the post-harvest processes of storage, of transportation, of communications, of price discovery for the farmers, of efficient markets to move it, that surplus then can create failure in itself by causing prices to collapse, by totally undermining farmers' incentive to continue to grow as much as possible. So it's not just looking at, well, how do we increase production? That's one part of it, but you got to do everything along the way. And as Jerry said, in terms of the food wastage, you know, if here it's what, 40% of all prepared food yeah. for consumption is thrown away in the United States. In Africa, routinely, 30 to 50% of the African harvest go to waste, not because they're throwing it away, but because the storage facilities are so flimsy, are so medieval, are so antiquated that it is spoiled by either pests that get in it, or by climate, by the rain, by the humidity, by the hot conditions. So that's the in terms of optimism, those are all, you know, low lying fruit that we ought to be able to, you know, figure out. We figured it out here, done it here, and in all the developed countries in the world. But it hasn't come to Africa basically for this lack of political will and determination.
That was truly one of the most shocking parts of your book, is sort of that explanation of the hungry farmer and of the food sitting, wasting away while so many people were starving. I mean, it truly is shocking. I can tell by the group that the questions are beginning to bubble, because I can see some eager hands about to raise up. But I want to just remind us for audience members, and keep in mind for those who are listening, that this is a particularly well-educated audience on the subject. The audience is really composed of anti-hunger advocates, community leaders, farmers, and other passionate community members. And so would you be kind enough, when you ask your questions, to say who you are so that folks who are listening can follow along that way? So KP Singh, would you like to start out? I've already announced you.
Thank you so much for a very illuminating discussion here about hunger. Hunger, as I think and has been said, is a universal challenge. It's an equal opportunity challenge for each of us. And in the Indian scriptures, we think of food as equivalent to God because it sustains life. And so the right to hunger is as important as the right to breathe and right to live and all the other things. One of the questions I hear, especially for Roger, is you mentioned about the Green Revolution. And we are very much aware of Green Revolution in Punjab, India. It was where Norman Borlaug experimented that, and we adopted and embraced it. But after years of being the breadbasket for the whole country of India, now we are realizing that there was so much fertilizer used to produce, to be the breadbasket for the entire country of India. And we are in surplus now in India versus when we were importing from the USA, that it has begun to affect the soil. It has begun to affect the health challenges. That's one question. The second question that is related to what I think Ted was trying to tell us about the technology, and that is there are many developing countries that are very hesitant with regard to food that are prepared, that are genetically engineered, so to speak. So could you both of you address that question for your for our audiences around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. And particularly and your experience in India with the Green Revolution, both the benefits that it brought, but then as time goes on, where you start seeing, okay, now also some negative impacts of that. And for the book, we spent quite a bit of time, both Scott and myself, with Dr. Borlaug and talking to him about this. And kind of what he was always very adamant and agitated about, in a sense, is that you need constant vigilance on this. After the Green Revolution, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970. And I think the world basically said, patted him on the back and said, great job, Dr. Borlaug, problem solved. And when he got it, they basically awarded him for solving, I think, for kind of severing the Gordian knot, or whatever they called it, of one of the great threats hanging, one of two great threats hanging over society at that time, the nuclear threat on the one hand, and then the threat that he could deal with of hunger, because then it was like, gee, we're going to eat ourselves to death, that we'll all starve, was the big fear in the 1960s. And what he warned about in his acceptance in his Nobel lecture the day after receiving the prize, he talked about criminal negligence. If we don't get on top of famine and hunger and stay with the Green Revolution and kind of adapt and adjust as it goes along. So these policies of fertilizer use, that as one had that experience and saw that what was happening, one should have been able to kind of moderate that, to withdraw the subsidies that were provided, to kind of pull them back and say, okay, farmers, you're on your own now. Fertilizer is very expensive, so be cautious with the way you're using it. The subsidies on electricity, that people were pulling the water out of the ground for irrigation. Now the water levels are so low that they were policies that the government needed to stay on top of and adjust as it went along. And now with bringing the Green Revolution to Africa, it's precisely those lessons that people like the Gates Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, are really aware of and trying to learn from. And there the application of fertilizer is basically done almost with a little spoon or a thimble, or their unit of measurement will also be the bottle cap from a Coke bottle. That is what the fertilizer is poured into, and that is what they apply to every plant, because they are not in the position, one, basically to afford fertilizer to begin with, and certainly to waste it. So everything that they're using, they want to make sure stays in the soil, doesn't run off. And then also with the water usage, that they're very cautious about that. And the thing I'll say, and Ted can talk about the biotech and the GMOs, is that kind of our thinking on Africa is that the Africans themselves need to be able to make this decision of whether they want to use these kind of crops. You referred to cotton, which I think Burkina Faso is now starting to use BT cotton. South Africa is basically the only country in sub-Saharan Africa that uses genetically modified seeds for food. There's some tests going on with drought-resistant seeds, but because of all this the battle and the controversy between Europe and the United States on that, a lot of that has played out in Africa, and so they haven't really taken decisions on this. And there's a great African saying that when the elephants fight, it's the grass that gets trampled. And so the elephants in this are the U.S. and Europe kind of battling over GMOs and biotech, and Africa's the grass, and they're being trampled. And so kind of for Africa to have a kind of a debate and quiet deliberations of what they want to do with this and go forward, and it's their decision whether they want to use these crops or not use them. And again, just on the use of hybrid crops, not even with the GMOs, they're so far behind in the use of hybrid crops that you know, for years they will be catching up on the use of them. So
just to follow up,
Todd.
No. It's Todd Leiden. I'd like to specifically address Jerry and talk about making this personal. What can we do as citizens, community members, to do this on a local basis? What are some of the things that we need to be thinking about? Obviously, there are problems throughout the world, but there are problems in our backyard. And what are the things that can be done to get this problem taken care of?
I think we have to be good stewards of our community. One of my Jerryisms is every day I'm vertical. I have an obligation to do something for somebody else. I hire students from Second Helpings. There's probably 18 that work at the field house. And their training is a 9-week training program, but it does not, that program is more than teaching them how to cook. It teaches them life skills. We take them to the bank. Some of them have never had a bank account. We have people come in and do resume writing. They get with Dress for Success. It's a holistic approach. I think providing opportunity and being informed. People don't have enough information. I think there's a lot of assumptions. We look at people and we're quick to judge based on a snapshot versus really understanding where people are coming from and what the issues are. The thing that people have to appreciate is whether we like it or not, if we don't do something to address the problem, the cycle just continues and we're not doing anything to help our own community. So it's not always about money. Sometimes it's about time, and time and attention is some of the things that people don't get. The reality of a lot of these people is what they see on TV, and when they walk out their front door, that's their snapshot of the world. So I would say volunteer. I would say get involved in the community. Find something that you're passionate about, because it's easy to do. I will always be passionate about feeding hungry people, because I was on the other side of that. But that may be something different for you. There's Big Sister, Big Brother mentoring programs. There's a lot of, unfortunately, single parent families. And some of those kids don't have mentors. And I think if we can stop the cycle by showing them something different besides what they see on TV and out their front door, that makes them better people, and it gives them and engages them and the opportunity to know that they can do something more with their lives.
Ted, did you have a follow-up comment to that?
Great. You said, my interpretation is to make it personal. I know that many in this room here, you know, the Farm Bureau has the hoppers for the hungry, meaning a hopper, a combine load of the pork producers have the million meals for pork, and who would miss the poultry folks when they're giving a gazillion turkeys at Thanksgiving? And I think there's a lot of that. I would say the one thing that we're finding, myself in included here, is that it's great to have, in our case, technology that we know is benefiting by producing more food. And I think, in my own experience on our family farm, it's terrific to provide a hopper for the hungry. But the difference that we've found is that personal engagement, the personal, call it what you want, the adoption of a family, the serving in a kitchen, the working in a food pantry. Then it really comes alive. It's not to say that all the other programs aren't good. They're terrific. They're necessary. Many times they're unknown. But we've found, and that's why we're so engaged on this personal mission focused on child hunger, that once you make it personal, it pops that bubble, and it just introduces so many more new and meaningful opportunities. That's what we're trying to do.
I just want to follow up on one other thing. At Second Helpings, we have 700 volunteers. That's the equivalent of 12 FTEs. They make us go. Our volunteers do all the meals. They bring the food in. They sort it. We have 13, 14 employees or people that work there, but it is the volunteers. And once you come in, and as the board, try to lead by example, and I try to get in the kitchen once a month, and it becomes a battle of how many kettles can you produce in a shift. And unless you can produce four, you really haven't made it to the – but it takes one day in the kitchen of understanding that every kettle feeds 600 people. That's 600 meals that you're producing, and you know that the gratification that you get from that. We have people who drive, people who you drive to one of these shelters, and the kids are running out going, the lunch man's coming. That touches you from a personal perspective. And I think people seeing things outside of the norm and seeing people who care genuinely and don't want anything from them just to help makes a big difference. And that's what's going to – we have to change the culture and the attitude. And I think that's what gets us there.
Yeah, Kira, I was going to say that kind of the outrage and inspire. This is the inspire. And that hunger is this problem that can be solved. And the reason I figure that or really believe in that is that it is something that everybody can do something about it. There is something out there, whether it's helping people abroad internationally or here at home, there is something to be done. And when I think about, the mustering of American leadership to kind of bring this to end hunger globally through agriculture development. The U.S. can't lead abroad while it has this hunger, while it has this big problem still at home. So it has to deal with the problem at home as it attacks hunger abroad. And for everybody in this country, there is some way to get involved in this issue. And it's all inspirational, it's all great, and it's all noble.
I'm Dave Miner with Bread for the World and active with the Indianapolis Food Resource Network. And I'll start with the Indianapolis side. But we found out working through the Indianapolis Food Resource Network that while there are literally hundreds of programs responding to the issue of hunger in Indianapolis, prior to the existence of the network, these efforts were completely uncoordinated. And so you've got lots and lots of people working, and yet you've got still probably, we estimate, 18,000 children just in Indianapolis who are frequently hungry. Now, you guys have touched on sort of the systemic parts of this and some of the key policy questions. We have lots and lots of people who will take cans of food to church for their collection or give a dollar to Gleaners or Second Helpings, or they interact with it at a very direct level, and that's natural and intuitive. How do we get some of them to rise up and deal with the systemic part of this as well? Because frankly, we'll never solve these problems, whether it's at home or whether it's abroad, if we don't look at the bigger picture. If it's only in the international context, it's I send money to these people who feed these people in this village. That's a wonderful thing for that village, but no, what about the bigger picture here? How do we move people to tackle more than just I give you a can of food?
I think if the biggest issue worldwide is communication. I believe that if you address any issue from Africa to the U.S. to England, there is a common denominator, and it is communication. There are hungry people who don't know where to get food when it's around the corner, two blocks down the street. I think we have to do a better job of, and not that we don't do a good job, but we have a lot of people working together independently, and we have to coordinate those efforts as the Indianapolis Food Resource Network is doing. We have to make it personal, and I think people need to understand where that can of food is going. I think they need to hear the story. I think people feel good when they could take a Cornelius who was dealing drugs on the street of Indianapolis, and we put him through a culinary training program, and last year he was a nominee for the Rose Award given by the ICVA, and he's now one of our lead guys, you know, in the kitchen. And they can understand the story of a guy who could be the guy who sticks you up on Saturday night or the guy you sit next to in church on Sunday. I think when people get that message and understand it, it'll make a difference.
That's a great point, communication. Do you guys have other comments on that? Because I think urgency and creating that urgency is critical here.
Yep, absolutely. With communication, that and Jerry was alluding to this, the whole notion of storytelling and the organizations that you're involved with to tell the stories, you know, particularly with all the social media and networking and things that are available, to tell the stories so that people can realize, oh, there are successes and what individuals do does have an impact. So the success of people that have had benefits of these services, but then also here's what it means when people become engaged and involved in this issue, and that you look at the problem of hunger and you figure, oh my goodness, there's so many. The numbers we throw around, 18,000 children in Indianapolis, a billion people hungry, those are huge numbers. Where do I get involved? It's such an overwhelming thing, but with kind of the great challenge comes this whole myriad of solutions and possibilities to get involved and be part of the solution of this. So the communication and telling the stories is absolutely vital.
But I think it goes back to something you said earlier. People don't think hunger has any impact on them. It doesn't affect me. The face of hunger does not look like it looked 20 years ago. If you take a snapshot, I had the Pacers feed. We invite shelters and we feed up to 600 people for Thanksgiving. One of my employees walked in with her kids, and I go, what are you doing here? She says, I live in a shelter. She comes to work every day. She's on time, no issues, and she lives in a shelter with her kids, and I had no idea. I think that people need to understand that there are people you work with that are going to a food pantry on Saturday, and you just don't know about it. They don't want to, you know, it's something that people don't really want to talk about, but people have to understand that it has an impact on us direct or indirectly, immediate or long-term. Everybody is impacted by the issue.
Ted, did you have something to add to that?
Just to say it is communication, yes, but it's got to be personal so that it's relevant. And then I think it doesn't solve all the problems. That, you know, there's lots of complexities to this, but I think it helps enlighten people so much more that it becomes personal. They can share it, and you can really then begin to address it. So communications plus the personal interaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a Humanities Council, we really appreciate the power of a story, and I think you're right. The power of a story can really transform in this particular issue.
Yeah, my name is AJ Schneider. I work with a company called Wheaton Worldwide Moving. We're a moving company. We became involved in a program called Move for Hunger about 18 months ago, where we pick up food from unwanted food from our customers and bring it to food pantries. But in working through that program, we had some interaction with folks at Feeding America and some of the local food banks we worked with, and there came this question of effectiveness and efficiency of collecting existing food versus dollars. So I guess that's my question to you guys, is to talk a little bit about dollars versus the food itself. And what we heard from Feeding America, which they were extremely appreciative of what we were doing, but they kind of pulled me aside and said, hey, listen, this is great. We'll always accept the food. But by the same token, if you can find opportunities to raise money, we can take those dollars and be much more targeted with what we need based on our clientele. Can you guys talk a little about that and if maybe we're missing the mark sometimes by concentrating on the food?
The answer is we need both. We were having this conversation a couple of minutes ago. We're in a very emotional business, and sometimes we have to separate the emotional from the strategic, from the tactical. You need a really good director of marketing. So if you're getting enough food, you need to go find somewhere to get cash. I mean, you need both, because we need equipment in the kitchen in order for the volunteers to be able to make the food, but you don't want to tell a donor, hey, that we take both, and if they don't need your food, just stop over and we will help get that disseminated for you. It really is. We were having a great conversation about people who started, they were growing in poverty, and they started doing these things for the right reasons. And Pam Altmaier, who started Gleaners, and it grows into this big thing, and you all of a sudden are a business. We're in business. Unfortunately, it's a business we would like not to be in, but we have to treat it as a business. You have to have a marketing plan. You have to have a strategy. And it's really, you're asking people for money. You're asking them to donate product. You have to have a plan. You have to have a strategic way of going about that and a balance. And it certainly, if we have a donor that we have wonderful donors who provide us, our marketing director knows that we need to balance that out with the need for cash so that we can operate as well. So the answer is you need both.
Particularly in developed or urban settings, I was wondering what role you saw for personal production and education for young folks or families that may be hungry, and how that could just be part of the discussion and in helping people understand how the food system and feeding the hungry.
Well, I'll take that. I think all of the above. You heard me say that we embrace choice. We embrace choice of how food is produced. We endorse choice when you get to the grocery store. And there's lots of opportunity. I mean, I grew up with a garden out back. It happened to be a large garden because we had the space. But you can have a small garden. You can have it on your planter box if you want. And I think getting into that spirit and making that personal, whether it's making it personal getting to know hunger or making it personal in raising food are both important. It could be, in some cases, livestock. Now, there's limitations on livestock in an urban setting for health and other reasons, neighbors, noise, that kind of thing. But it's not impossible. No. It's not impossible. And so I personally, and certainly our company, endorse trying those different things. And anyway, in many ways, it's a returning to our roots, where there were a couple chickens, a cow. But I think that novel idea, that utopia, if you will, has got to be balanced with the reality. I'm not sure that if we did that, we would be able to feed this growing population. So it is both. And I, back to the main theme I'm trying to sound. Is that let's do that. It's fun. It's challenging, exciting. It's engaging people. But nor is it a reason to dismiss new technologies or larger operations. I think there's room, in fact, plenty of room for both. And there's a lot of successes coming from the local production, those mm-hmm. backyard experiences. You bet. Let's bring them on.
And urban lots and a lot of the Absolutely. Other things that we're seeing, I think, are really kind of transforming people's knowledge of the food growing process, because I think it's one of those interesting things. I know, Ted, you and I have talked about as folks who grew up in rural areas, that people have kind of gotten away from understanding where food comes from. So that's another great connector to the land.
Yeah, I'll never forget getting to know Judy O'Bannon, our former first lady, when she and Frank were living in that home near Martin University. She called up because she wanted some idea on how to handle a garden and technology and science and soil science and seeds and the like. And so it was my first experience to see how you can use a garden to bring a community together. And I literally witnessed kids mm-hmm. a little nervous to come across the street. Mm-hmm. Eventually they did. And in the process, we learned about basics, I'd add, but mm-hmm. basics of agronomy and soil science. But you also learned about people and getting along and production, all those things. It was terrific.
Well, food building community, that's a great example of that.
We're going to have to, at some point, get outside the box and get innovative and say, here are some options and here are some opportunities. There's a program underway right now with Clarion to do fresh vegetables to sell literally at cost to travel to neighborhoods. Okay. We have to get outside what we know and what our comfort zone is, and how can we be innovative and create these ideas that'll work. So, I mean, imagine a fresh fruit and vegetable truck that comes through your community at some point where you can actually buy, because there are food deserts that are yeah. miles long. It's amazing. Yeah. And if you don't have public transportation or access to transportation, your food shopping is done at a 7-Eleven. There will be a website for the Indiana Food Resource Network. We have convened community. We've actually asked pantries to come in and talk to us about it. And there were people sitting there going, I have a pantry two blocks from me. I had no idea you guys were. So we're, you know, really trying to collaborate that. And without giving away of a lot, we're talking about looking at zip codes and bringing all those little guys together. And maybe you call it, I don't know what we decided to call it at the end, Super Pantry was thrown around. But it's a collaborative effort, and I believe that sometime very soon we will have a website.
Well, we have had quite a discussion here. We've opened up a lot of issues that I think now all of us need to learn more about. I want to thank Roger, Ted, and Jerry for being our wonderful panel, and I want to thank all of you who are working in the field right now in the issue and for your participation and thoughtful questions. We didn't really expect to solve world hunger in this conversation today, but we do hope that by raising awareness, provoking conversation, we've helped move closer to a solution. Across the globe, as Rogers pointed out, we do see a new desire to fight hunger, whether it's the desire to reduce the overwhelming numbers that define hunger, or a desire to reduce the suffering of individuals. We know there's no single solution, but we also know that no solution is possible without the compassionate and determined debate, innovation, and action. That's why we at the Indiana Humanities Council have made hunger a focus of Food for Thought for 2011 with our family of farmers friends, and why we're proud to work with and be inspired by local leaders, such as those who appear here today, and Pacers Sports and Entertainment President Jim Morris, who served for 5 years as Executive Director of the United Nations World Food Program and who's a co-chair of this initiative. Also, I have to mention Senator Richard Lugar, who has a legendary history of involvement in the issue and who's also graciously served as a co-chair of Food for Thought. Finally, I want to thank once again our co-host, Indiana's Family of Farmers, as well as WFYI, for giving us the opportunity to include lots of Hoosiers who will be listening in this important conversation. As Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently remarked, the question is not whether we can end hunger, it's whether we will. So thank you all for being here.